Ladies and gentlemen, I would like at this time to introduce Jonathan Krim from WashingtonPost.com and Michael K. Powell, former chair of the FCC and currently venture capitalist, advisor to large companies, large and small.
My wife.
Wife and kids, and technology hacker and bon vivant, right?
I hope so, yes.
Okay, take it away, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for joining us today. I'll just say by quick, brief introduction, I think most of you know the chairman's basic resume. I will say that I think he's a perfect candidate for this conversation because in my time covering technology policy for the Washington Post, he was one of the very few public officials who both understood a lot about the technology that he was involved with regulating and making policies on, and also very willing to engage in a lot of the philosophical issues that have been part of the conversation here today. So let's just dive right in. I want to read you something real quick first on spectrum policy, which has been a big topic here. In 2002, the FCC Spectrum Policy Task Force, which you had a great deal to do with, released a report calling for shifting large amounts of spectrum from the current command and control allocation system to both licensed and unlicensed use. Since then, the FCC has started numerous proceedings to follow through on these recommendations. But whereas the proceedings granting flexible use to incumbent license holders have been fast-tracked and or completed, the proceedings seeking to allocate more unlicensed spectrum have, with only one notable exception, been sidetracked. As a result, there's actually less unlicensed spectrum available today in the high penetration beachfront frequencies below 3 gigahertz than there was in 2002. So my question is, do you agree with that? And if so, what do you think's going on?
First of all, let me pick up from what I heard made earlier. I do think what you are talking about is a radicalization of the spectrum management model. And by the way, the spectrum management model is built almost entirely on the history of broadcast TV. So in many ways, it's badly distorted because its sort of legacy comes out of television and not the kinds of innovative and creative market-enhancing uses that are clamoring for its spectrum now, which is why things like battling over the 700 megahertz in the DTV transition take on much greater importance today than they might have taken at the time that that regime was initially created. I've always been a big fan of open spectrum and tried to be a champion for Wi-Fi and unlicensed uses, and I think we did try to strike fairly quickly in solidifying the existing 2 gigahertz bands and trying to find more in the 5 gigahertz bands. Why does it get harder after that? Well, first of all, what spectrum do you want to talk about? There is very little spectrum left in the government's closet that is just sort of easy to dispense without complication. But more importantly, spectrum requires the most mind-numbing level of coordination across entities that you may not be aware of. I have more scars and blood from going up against the Department of Defense over Wi-Fi, ultra-wideband, or the Department of Transportation over potential interference on GPS systems by introducing more open spectrum, right? To them, a lot of times, open spectrum means people we can't find when there's a problem. And so to the extent that from the consumer level, that might be a great value. From a lot of significant spectrum use purposes, public safety, local state police, defense department, transportation power. And oh, by the way, harmonization in the global forums at the ITU, which is more mind-numbing than anything that you do with Department of Defense. That's why the actual mechanics of continuing to follow the blueprint are extremely, extremely difficult.
But why do we seem to be making much more rapid progress if this statement is correct, with flexible use licensing to incumbents rather than purely open unlicensed use? I mean, it would seem to me those interdepartmental conflicts exist throughout the band.
I just think, put simply, increasing flexible use for spectrum that is existent and in the market is just an easier regulatory task than finding new and additional spectrum that's yet spoken for. Just mechanically, those are two different things. I also would say I don't necessarily accept they're only for the incumbents. I mean, a lot of the companies that came to us urging service rules for flexible allocations or secondary market initiatives were innovative companies who had new and creative business models that were going to sort of at some level challenge incumbent wireless users, and they needed to be able to come to auction or at whatever system the government employs to distribute spectrum and ensure that it had a sufficient amount of flexibility, because a lot of times those business models are quasi-experimental, which means they, till they get the spectrum and get out there and try it, there's some risks to it, and what they want often is the maximum amount of flexibility so that they're not cabined in some rule and find out they need to sort of change the mask or something and then have to constantly go back and forth to the government. So I guess I don't accept that the flexibility, you know, my view of spectrum is it should be like a driver's license. You know what, here's the driver's license, here are the technical rules, don't speed, don't kill anybody, but I don't care what color car you drive. And I don't care where you take it. And I think that's flexibility in the real sense of the word. And I think that's just as much for innovators as incumbents. Indeed, most of the heat we got usually came from entrenched license-holding incumbents.
Just so the audience knows, too, I should have said this up front. We'll go back and forth for a few minutes and then very much open it up to you guys so you'll have an opportunity to jump in on all of these things. I want to move a little bit over to another of the big hot-button issues here today, and that's net neutrality. And obviously, you heard a lot of discussion here about everybody's definition being slightly different and so on and so forth. But I want to talk about one thing that I have heard fairly much in common throughout this debate. And Vince Cerf of Google has been making this point repeatedly. And that is that the core net neutrality fight that's going on now really wouldn't exist if there were more than a duopoly in broadband provisioning. And that is a regime that largely grew up under your tenure through the deregulatory policy. So I'd like to get your thinking about the level of platform competition that truly exists today for most Americans and whether or not we do have a competitive marketplace that would in some ways render the net neutrality debate more moot.
I agree with Vin. I think it's a good point. If you were asking me personally, no, I'm not satisfied that the country's where it should be on the number of competitive distribution platforms. That's a given. But it's a snapshot in time. I think it's a heck of a lot better than the 100 years of allowing only 1 mile and one carrier that the government embraces as a monopoly single provider of last mile. It is true that I could say the average consumer tends to have at least two and others coming. And what I would like to see is government dedicate more of its noise, more of its energy, more of its resources to driving innovation, research, development, and deployment of alternative platforms than the kind of internecine food fights that tend to capture the imagination of the regulatory legislative process, and we would all be better off. I've always believed that the key to a productive information age future is multi-platform competition. And we did a lot of things, of course, in the DSL cable world, but I think those things are trivial compared to what we were trying to do in the broadband over the power line world, in the Wi-Fi world, on spectrum management. I mean, if we're going to get the Star Trek world that I dream of, right, which no matter where we go, we'll flip open our communicator and be connected to the world's information, a third pipe has to be spectrum. I mean, we should never rest until, at a minimum, there's a very powerful, both fixed, mobile, and nomadic version of spectrum broadband that takes hold across the United States. And as every antitrust lawyer knows, and you should know, I'm an antitrust lawyer, we believe magical things happen at three. That when you start to get the competitive dynamic that goes on among three people, it gets much harder to do some of the things that are hypothesized that cause the greatest anxiety about net neutrality. So yeah, I mean, the current legislative debate is one thing about net neutrality, but your other point is actually the more important over time. Because I think if you don't ultimately get multiple platforms for distribution competition, you run the risk of collapsing into the 100-year-old monopoly-centric regulatory model. By the way, yes, that will hurt incumbents, but I promise you it'll hurt this community too.
But let me just dive in a little deeper here. It seems to me what you've outlined is a bit of a bet. Your scheme throughout your tenure was to allow functionally the elimination of intra-platform competition.
Well, let me stop you. Okay. Let me stop. First of all, because there are very few things I truly bristle over, this is one of them.
All right.
The biggest promise for that capability was something called line sharing, in which competitors were able to use the high-frequency lines to offer competition and choice, which has been the key to what's happened in Japan and Asian parts of the country. In the telephone rule battle, which is one of the biggest food fights I ever saw, I dissented because the majority eliminated line sharing.
You're
and I tried yet again to reintroduce line sharing after the court struck down the rules, which I was positive they were going to do, and it provided an opportunity to come to consensus and put line sharing back. And you're going to have to ask the majority at the FCC at the time, who are all still there, why they voted to kill it. So
I stand corrected.
You can criticize me for anything that you want, but not stuff I didn't do.
Point taken. I was in the room when it happened. In any event, we now have a situation where, as you said, it's a snapshot in time. But a lot of things are happening very quickly in this moment where we only have two. We don't have the magic of three. And a lot of people in this room are particularly concerned about the downstream impact of the functioning of two, which is all of the assault on net neutrality that they see. Are you confident that three is going to come quickly enough so that the market doesn't get terribly skewed?
You know, to me, depending on where you sit, it seems to me you're right to always be impatient. That, you know, what is quick enough? I do think in the history of infrastructure deployment, it's pretty darn quick compared to anything else you're going to compare it to. I mean, I've looked at this. I mean, if you want to go through the deployment history of indoor plumbing, you want to go through the deployment history of electrification of the United States, if you want to go through the deployment of the interstate highway system or the railway system, I'll stack the pace of broadband creation and deployment against any one of those any day. That doesn't mean, so what you're getting across the economy is an enormous sort of 20x increase in the speed of change across all markets and all economy. So this, and the software industry, and I would say the sort of applications industry is probably the fastest moving. So it's understandable, I completely, you know, been to the sort of subscription that to that community, that's an impatient pace. But the funny thing about infrastructure is, remember, it is a construction project more than it's anything else. You're talking about stuff that has to go out and get dug up, built, zoning approved, holes dug, yards penetrated, poles accessed, wires put at the top of things. I just think there's no real belief that will ever sort of proceed at the pace that some would have it in an application software business. But that said, I am very bullish, and that's why I like this country's model, even though we'll complain that we're 10th or 16th or whatever. I think one day we'll look back and be proud that this country pursued a policy that tried to generate multiple platforms instead of putting all their eggs in the basket of another platform just to get penetration quickly. By the way, that's exactly what the United States did in 1919. It wanted telephone so bad it let Theodore Vail and AT&T have it, because monopoly is an extraordinarily efficient way of getting universal service. If you want to go to Ed Whitaker tomorrow and say, I'll give you the whole internet, if you get everybody on it quickly at 100 megabits, I guarantee you'll accelerate the efficiency of this thing. But creating competition and alternate platforms is messier and will be slower, but it will have a much bigger payoff, in my judgment, if we achieve it. And I just think, I wish as much energy at the Commission and in Congress would go into how do I make Bill Berkman of Current continue to have success in deploying broadband over power line? How do I further advance open spectrum and Wi-Fi? How do I get the DoD off of ultra wideband so that's a powerful alternative? How do you get WiMAX really reaching homes? How do you get Craig McCaw and Clearwire, you know, humming? How do you lower the cost of capital? How do you incent this stuff with tax policy? Last thing I would say, somebody here said something really wise about the overall problem in this country. I am amazingly frustrated that public policy doesn't recognize how deeply critical this is to the United States' future as a great empire in the information age. This is about our children. I have talked loud until I'm blue in the face that the problem, by the way, is we should stop talking about tech policy as if it's a utility This is about every facet of public policy. Tech policy is education policy. Tech policy is healthcare policy. Tech policy, you know, is the social welfare state. It is, you know, and what I feel is missing is that politicians keep draining this debate off into its own little bucket, where I'm waiting for a presidential candidate to go out there and say, my healthcare policy is all about technology. My education policy is how to make children technically literate and be competitive in the 21st information system. That's what's got to happen before we really get rolling.
So one last point on net neutrality. Would you then side with those who say it doesn't make sense to regulate in any way the market providers to prevent neutrality, and in while we're in this snapshot of only two?
Let me take a different tact, because I think this is the one that I'd want to, if I were going to give a message to this community. You know, I was one of the early public officials who stood up and talked about net neutrality. I called it net freedoms at the time and still subscribe to it wholeheartedly. But I'm also a student of Washington and regulatory process, and I'm worried for what's going on. The gospel of open internet and edge innovation seems to me to have great merit. But I am very worried about putting your faith in the governmental oversight process to guarantee it for you. We're playing this community, in my mind, is playing a potentially dangerous game for a couple reasons, and I'm just going to spit them out and we can move on. But number one, the legislative process does not work well when it has a very weak understanding about innovation and technology. And you were talking about 536 members who've got to get this, or at least 60% or 51% of them. I can probably count on my two hands who I think those might be. So I think they have a very shallow current understanding of tech. If you go give a quiz about the seven layers of the internet, good luck. So be careful of inviting the legislative process when they have a very bad understanding of the technical underpinnings, because the secondary consequences of their errors can be enormous. Number two, I think be careful. You live by the sword, you die by the sword. I'm a big believer in subversion or jujitsu when it comes to this stuff, which is let the weight of inertia be on your side, which is mean I would rather try to constantly position my industry where I succeed if government does nothing, versus positioning it in a way where I need them to do something or I'm dead. Because if you're in a position you desperately need them to do something or you're dead, start ordering your coffin and digging the plot, because this process is cumbersome, slow, and deliberative. And the other thing is, you can believe in a snapshot of time, you can trust the government, by the way, who will have a vague definition because they don't get it well enough. If this community doesn't understand it, as I heard, I can tell you right now, very few people in Washington do, which means you're going to get a potentially very ambiguous, subject to massive variations in interpretation kind of law. Now, personalities change, political power changes, congressmen come and go, presidents change. You're living with sort of this perpetual cycle of interpretation. And by the way, it's always easier to get a law on the books than to ever get it off again. If it goes on, be prepared that it's there for 15 to 20 years. And the other thing is, I think government has a way of turning on people, which is, ask Bill Gates, which is, it may be about networks today, but those same principles can be used against innovative business models and applications in another context. And I submit to you, they would be. They would be. It might have to do with interoperability of your new product with somebody else's product. It may have to do with servers and caching. Someone will think it's a good idea to apply the same basic principles to the other side of the community. Third and lastly, for the moment, I would say, be careful because you're playing their game. Regulatory battles are an art form, and these guys are the maestros. It's always a little like Brer Rabbit. Oh, woe is me, throw me on the briar patch and regulate me. Well, the average one of these incumbents, whether they're cable or phone company, you have 40 lawyers in Washington dedicated to this work. Resources, ability, 100 years of skill, not criticizing, only saying the reality. And then I meet entrepreneurs who have 12 guys and can't afford a legal cost center, research. And then let me add the judicial process. Every decision you get from the Congress or the FCC will spend the next 3.5 to 4 years in court.
So speaking of free markets. Should governments be prohibited from launching municipal wireless networks?
No, not in my judgment. Look, where I think government can be good is when it puts its money where its mouth is and tries to stimulate through the power of its offices demand. Right, the government is a huge demand creator. And you know, if government is both as a buyer or through its influence can generate higher levels of broadband demand, then I think it is a very, very powerful pull on the economy to make business models that need to deploy invest risk capital do it, number one. Number two, I think absolutely we know two is not enough. I would be worried if at the end of the day, muni networks were run by muni bureaucrats and it was somehow never privatized, because I don't have a lot of confidence in local governments to continually innovate, to find the capital, to continue to fund and support. We've seen this in stuff like E911 and public safety. You can go to Conference of Congress and believe in an advanced 911 system, and at the end of the day, you always had the same problem. Local government's broke. And local government's broke, can't figure out how to do it, can't fund it, can't spend it. And so E911 continues in some ways to languish in various ways, because even when industry steps up to their side of the equation, the local governments can't meet them. And so I think it's great because it's stimulating, it's aggravating, it creates an opportunity to bring in people. But I think it's going to be a mistake, though, if you know I'm going to rely on the Cincinnati City Council to provide, you know, my critical broadband access over and innovate over time.
Let me throw one last more philosophical question at you, and then we'll open it up. There was a discussion, interestingly, in the last session, I think before you arrived, in which the two panelists were talking a little bit about how we frame conversation about the internet and so on and so forth. And in the policy arena, what I have heard a lot, particularly from the corporate side, is a frame that is very much oriented around private property rights. And I'm wondering whether it's fair for consumers in this country to think of the internet as a public place, even understanding that there are rules and tariffs and so on and so forth. But fundamentally, I think what grew up in this country was this was greenfield and a public place, not necessarily a public utility, but in some ways maybe so. And a lot of the argument has been to pull away from that and to create essentially a series of private places. Is that a fair construct? Does it resonate at all?
It's interesting. We're just doing philosophy. I think the conception of it as a public place is the right metaphor, at least sort of uber metaphor to sort of guide your deliberations. But we also have to be sort of pragmatic and realistic about the way things really work. And by the way, some of this nobody has any discretion to change. For example, an infrastructure owner does have property rights and even has a Fifth Amendment in the Constitution that protects them at some level. For example, the government, no matter what assertion of public good, would probably find itself in unconstitutional territory if it suddenly swooped in and tried to nationalize infrastructure. All right, so the metaphor is useful, but of course, if you're going to be a realist, you're going to have to live with the realities of certain components that are going to have property and private interest pieces attached to it. The second thing I would say is, you know, look, as long as it's a capitalist society, and I also believe this is true for the engine that drives innovation, entrepreneurs want to get paid. And I don't mean very many entrepreneurs who are just in it to make a social statement. A lot of them are in it to create a product that's compelling and to sell it and be able to secure enough ownership and rights in that to profit from the risks they took. And I think that as long as you need one of the drivers of investment and innovation to be private gain, it's too facile to say, oh, somehow everything belongs to the American public. My friend and advisor, Chris Lebertelli, is hitting here. I'm sure Nicholas Zennstrom is not of the mind that at the end of the day, Skype should just belong to the public. or anyone else who's creating something of value. And why should it, by the way? You invented it. And I think part of your motivation to invent it is to be rewarded for it. And so as long as there's going to be a mechanism of a producer chasing value for consumers in exchange for compensation or profit, you know, it is inherently a private sector system that has a major driver to be sort of chasing innovation. And then the last thing I would say is what I'm worried about sometimes for those who are most married to the metaphor of the public space, they run into a little trouble when they start trying to figure out who's supposed to pay for everything. And there's often a quick, kind of convenient answer, well, the government should. Ladies and gentlemen, our government's not paying for any of this stuff. It's broke. It's going to stay broke for a really long time. The Tennessee Valley project for broadband is not coming. And I don't ever like to debate this one, even philosophically. I don't care about whether you believe they should or they shouldn't. I'm just telling you what's going to happen. And it's not coming. So if it's not coming, that means if we don't like 16th in the country in broadband, and we want 100 megabyte infrastructure and not 1.5 DSL, you know, then you're going to have to be cognizant of, we have to generate models that continue to force private capital to flow into that desire, because I just don't think the cavalry is coming from the public sector to fund that stuff.
Who wants to go first?
I do.
Uh-oh.
You get to do that.
Chairman Powell, at the FCC, you did at least three really great things, one of which survives, and that is that you committed to creating a more technologically literate commission. And that's great, and I'm glad that that continues. Then you initiated this spectrum policy rethinking from scratch, and that actually stopped when you left, as far as I can tell. And the third thing that I thought was a really great step forward was the articulation of the four internet freedoms, which in the current restatement, I believe they've been significantly watered down and made subject to service agreements and network providers' assessment of network harm and so on. So there's these two things, the four freedoms and spectrum reform, that stop. Why did you leave so soon? But more
8 years, not so soon. But
I know you were there a long time. But more importantly, what's the prognosis going forward, and what would you advise us as potential activists and people who are naive but want to get involved in policy?
Wow, that's hard. But on spectrum reform, you know, I've just lived my life in Washington. These things are wars. You have to get dirty. You have to get down in the trenches, right? And the way you win in public policy is you go three steps forward and be prepared to go one to two steps back. You rarely get to sort of linearly progress in the right direction. You have to go to war, fight hard, move the ball to here, and be prepared that somebody's going to kick it back a foot or two. But as long as you're one step out of the three ahead, you're still winning. For example, on Spectrum Policy Task Force, I giggle about certain things that at the time we proposed them were outright heresy. We were going to get murdered over. For example, I'm not so sure it's completely dead. We talked about letting spectrum users use white space of the broadcast spectrum. Broadcasters almost took our head off for even suggesting it. There's legislation foaming around congressmen openly talking about that. When we floated taking the DTV spectrum back in 2009, we got attacked with enormous vigor out of the broadcasting community. No way there should be a hard date, not on your life. And my only sort of wuss out was that I didn't do it myself under commission authority in my waning days. I confessed to wussing out. But Congress picked it up. And I consider the return of that prime beachfront property at 700 megahertz by 2009 an enormous victory for the wireless community. In a way, when I started, people, Congress is in the pocket of broadcasters. There's no way in this lifetime we're ever going to turn back the analog spectrum. And the card seems to have changed on that. And I think that's a positive outgrowth of spectrum talking and advocating and pointing out the importance of spectrum policy. So other things have stopped, which, a quick statement about that, is a cautionary tale. Again, if you put your marbles in the regulatory process, just remember the average commissioner is there 2 to 3 years, and the legislature turns over every election, and no matter how compelling an idea, you can run into a group that either that's just not their priority, or they don't understand it, or they don't see it your way, and it can come to a screeching halt. You know, four freedoms, I will tell you, you know, same thing. At some point, you can't be commissioner for life, and, you know, you hope these things continue in the constructive way. You know, the commission in some ways embraced most of it. I don't like their switch at the end of it. When all of a sudden a network, an internet concept has a footnote attached to it referring back to the Telecom Act, you got a problem. And it does. And I think that it sounds innocuous, but I know what the art, what the meaning of most of those words are, and my own view is they're not constructed. And by the way, that's what Congress is thinking it should codify.
Let's go to another, right here. David?
Michael Calabrese, New America Foundation.
Sure.
That was a good point, you know, and it should be mentioned too, I think, fairly, that in terms of the clearing the broadcasters off channels 52 to 69, John McCain in particular deserves tremendous credit because he picked that, when it stalled, you know, at the FCC, he picked that up and attached the, you know, what was needed politically, the consumer converter subsidy, in order to get that through Congress. And now that will, most of that will be auctioned for licensed services. We had wished some of that was unlicensed on a dedicated basis, so that we could have commodity equipment costs for unlicensed. Of course, there still is channels 2 to 51, which you mentioned earlier, which is, and I mentioned earlier when I spoke, that it's, you know, 30% vacant in even busy areas, and as much as 75-80% vacant in many rural areas. You had said you wish that, you know, that had gotten completed. I mean, do you think, what about these, you know, do you think that Congress should direct the FCC to complete the proceeding at this point? Is that what it's going to take? And
well, in fairness to Congress and the leadership of McCain and others, I mean, they're moving to the law that's going to mandate it, which I think is better than trying to get the FCC to do it. I mean, there's certain things the FCC is a powerful political, more powerful political pair than the legislature.
Yeah, and then the question is why? Why can't we count on the FCC to just to do this by itself? Because it's...
I can tell you why, because it's why I wussed out, which is you're on somewhat thin statutory ground in the way that you interpret the statute. Congress doesn't have that problem. It can make the law whatever it wants. But we were admittedly trying to apply a very aggressive interpretation of the statute in a way that we thought we could compel the end of the DTV transition. Now, we were going to get sued on it the minute we did it, and we might have lost. And it might have taken 3 years to find out, which, by the way, it's 2006 now, which means it would take to 2009 just to be told we didn't have the power. I think the fact that Congress picked up the mantle will probably pass a law this year, and it'll be statutorily required to be over in 2009, means we probably saved 3 years of wasted time getting to that point. And I certainly would be open to somebody thinking about some of that being for unlicensed.
Right.
Thank you, Mike.
Next. We have one up here. Wait for the mic, please. Thank you.
First, I want to thank Jonathan for honoring me by quoting from one of my issue briefs and your opening on the difference in the rhetoric and the reality of allocation of unlicensed spectrum since 2002. But my question is for Chairman Powell. You made the comment that the government
should turn it toward your mouth. Turn the knob. Turn the ball toward your mouth.
Oh, this way. I'm sorry. Words with deeds, and you specifically mentioned purchasing. So I have two purchasing ideas where the government could play a huge role, I think, in spectrum policy. One is in public safety. you were a key player behind the 4.9 gigahertz public safety band. Cisco now has dual mode phones, which use the 5 gigahertz unlicensed band with the 4.7 for a token amount. When the government encourages, well, when it's purchasing for public safety, and there's going to be a huge amount of government purchases, should they be buying dual mode public safety devices to use unlicensed and licensed and mandated that in the purchasing specification? And then a similar question on the intelligent transportation system software, which also came in your administration at 5.9, also immediately adjacent under unlicensed, completely compatible. When we start in the next 3 to 5 years building out, you know, 500,000 intersection, you know, wireless nodes, millions within 10 years, should those also have not just the ITS receiving ability, but also unlicensed? So we would have essentially a highway Wi-Fi network. For example, we could build for an incremental cost if it's part of the purchasing specification. So there are two major purchasing decisions, tens of millions possibly of radios in the next decade, and should unlicensed be part of those devices?
Yeah, on the surface of the specific examples, I didn't hear anything I wouldn't agree with, but I think the most important thing that comes out of what you said to my mind is what we just don't have enough of, which is when you're talking about a different public policy challenge, are you thinking, are you with some enlightenment thinking about how you can advance your information age goals simultaneously and take advantage of that opportunity? I mean, we used to argue in forums in the wake of 9/11 and hurricanes and all kinds of disasters that have hit the United States, that you could integrate exactly what you're saying, basically that we should marry up our response to national security problems and disaster relief problems with advances that would also advance the thing. Here's one of the problems we have. Our government sort of has a broken mechanism in the sense that where do you take that problem? The FCC is very powerful, but it's also very limited within its organic statute, and it's not a member of the administration. Transportation has a Secretary of Transportation that are part of the President's cabinet. The FCC does have some limitations on its ability to be sort of the spokesman of integrating broader government policy because it doesn't have a seat at that table. I had a protocol rank equivalent to the cabinet secretary, but I didn't sit at the President's table.
Should we have a secretary for technology?
Maybe we should, or at least you should be able to look at any administration and know who's in charge of what you just said. And I don't know that right now, and I served both during the Clinton administration and this administration, you'd have a hard time looking across the org charts and deciding who integrates the answer to that problem. And that, so sometimes what breaks down is not just the policy, the philosophy, but just sort of the organizational structure to be responsive to it. I think that's a problem, actually.
Right here.
This is good. I like the ITS.
And then we'll go back over there. Don't lose your hand next time.
Yes, Chairman Powell, you described your concern about a Cincinnati City Council, say, providing essential broadband. And certainly the public-private partnerships that describe most of the municipal wireless projects around the country are in many ways ideal if properly set up. However, we do have some localities where there are one or none in terms of providers, or we have other circumstances such as New Orleans where the mayor and the CIO are trying to provide those services. But the telcos and state laws are interfering with that. I wonder, do you have concerns about the private sector trying to limit the government when it's the only option to provide that magic third pipe?
Yeah, that's a good question. But play it on a grown-up field, right? Which is, I used to take the view that companies don't have personalities. They're all profit-maximizing, greedy, right? In the way that, by the way, they're supposed to be. And so nothing surprises me if you want to go to San Antonio, that you're going to run into AT&T lobbyists in the halls of the state legislature trying to have that not happen. I can't particularly fault them for using the mechanism. And that's why I don't like when certain things go to a governmental playing field, because now you're opening up a game in which, you got to take on companies not only in the marketplace, but you got to take them on in state capitals as well. And so you know, look, they're protecting their self-interest and their shareholders in a way that I would expect. But I think that this community, and when I say that, I mean that in the most broad way, right? I mean sort of the loose internet content. You know, we don't even have a good description for what this community is. It's not near, it has a long way to go to be better organized, to speak with a clearer voice, to have a higher level of sophistication that takes, but there are good cases to be made for this stuff. And there are, you know, and by the way, you have to learn how to convert them to really simple, right? You know, why is your constituent better off than not? And so yeah, I mean, it concerns me, but it doesn't concern me in the sense that it's just the cost of the reality, the way this stuff works. And so, you know, we can sit around and sort of do this a lot or just really figure out how to get there earlier. You know, when we were working at the FCC, we used to be frustrated how we'd see something coming. We'd call companies up, call industries up. Hey, you got to get here. No, but, you know, they're not there. Not at the hearing, not at the FCC forum. Vaughn and others have been. You know, but, you know, you really start to have to get organized if you're going to play that game. I don't have a good answer for you.
Let's go to this gentleman with the microphone.
The questions, first of all, thank you very much for coming here.
You're very welcome.
Very much enjoying the dialogue. The question is a very simple one, whether the common carrier model is a good one for where we're headed. A little bit of background. Last year, Mark Cooper of the Consumer Federation of America was a speaker here, and he taught us a little bit about the history, the canals that had to be regulated as common carriers, the places, the inns along the toll roads where travelers were compelled to stay overnight had to be accept the public and have posted rates. And we've been through this as a nation for the canals, the toll roads, the inns along the toll roads, the telegraphs, the railroads, the telephones later, and of course the freight carriers themselves. Why isn't it going faster? Of course, you said I should be patient, but haven't we learned something? Do you have any suggestions for how the country should be proceeding? Surely we always had someone's ox being gored in the past. We've always had conflicts, entrenched interests, and all of the prior historic pageants. Do you have any comments on this pageant?
Sure. Thanks. Well, one, I don't think you should be patient, by the way. I think you should be impatient. But I think your impatience should be dosed with the pragmatic realities of what's within the... You know, you have to have a time element, right? You have to be somewhat sensitive to what you achieve. Because I think if you're impatient and you go for too much at the wrong time with the wrong people, you can rue the day of what transpired, which might be the danger of some of the net neutrality stuff. I'll be honest with you. I loathe the common carrier model.
Why?
You like it, don't you? Well, because I don't think it's nearly as glorious as you suggest. First of all, the common... Well, you're not suggesting... It does, by the way, loathing the common carrier model is not the same thing of saying being vigilant to anti-competitive behavior or having a model that addresses that. So that's the first thing to get clear. But one of the biggest problems in the history of the common carrier model, first of all, I've done a lot of research. Mark's a great guy, and we're friends. We don't always agree, but we're friends. The Queen invents the common carrier model. It works this way. I shall grant you exclusive use of my lands in exchange for your commitment to serve all people equally. It has two components historically. Serve all people, but also I grant you state sovereign-supported monopoly. A level of exclusivity. And even when it isn't stated, a huge part of the history of common carriage, when I look at it, is the constant back and forth between the crown and the monopolist over the conditions by which the monopoly's exclusivity is protected and a few consumer-enhancing benefits are given. And it is an extraordinarily cumbersome regulatory process, because if you marry a monopolist, you build up enormous amounts of rules because you're worried about things that monopoly. We have forgotten in the heyday of common carrier and telephone, you would have 5-year rate-making proceedings in states just to set the price of telephone service. You would forget that these guys would come in with 400 lawyers and dockets this high, which, by the way, now you'll have to be on the other side of the table arguing against, to say why we need a guaranteed rate of return. Or, you know, more importantly, I think the other literature, right, who would take the other view, maybe Mark, like Alfred Kahn would say, the other thing that happens is those aren't particularly great innovative industries. That the mechanism that causes innovation gets stymied because if you're common carrier monopolist, you don't see any real reason. And the government has to constantly try to prime the common carrier regulated company to do innovation. It almost has to pay for it with ransom. And I just worry, I'm not so sure that I want the model for the internet to be, you know, 16-gauge rails for, you know, Northern Pacific, or that Theodore Vail's AT&T is where my ambitions lie for the future of the internet, you know, or ferries across the River Thames. I mean, I just think those are very commodity, industrial age industries that do not have a high premium on innovative and fast-paced change.
We have time for one more. This woman.
I'll talk to you after it drinks if you didn't get your.
Can you wait for the mic?
Who's asking?
The woman right here. Thank you.
Thank you. Alicia McDonald. Very briefly, Chairman, you've discussed a number of things we should not do as a community, as a group, how we would not succeed. I haven't heard a lot from you as to how we would succeed on a tactical level. Do you have any advice?
Like, if you were chairman of the
FCC. If I was. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a hard, only because what do you want, what is success? I mean, what do you want, you know, what do you want out of it? Well, don't we all, okay. I like this. I'm hearing what you want.
I mean, the short version, the long version, but it's basically, I want less favors to prevent me from doing things myself.
Yeah.
Republican is, you know, self.
Yes.
Puppies.
Smurfs.
It's
a good. It's a good question. No. I'll focus it on public policy because I don't know.
Let's say that together we come up with an agenda. We have the new agenda for public policy from this group.
Okay. One thing I really believe in is that I think at moments in time, in regulation and market expectations, there is a short window for establishing and acclimating the consumer base to a set of expectations that's hard to ever pull back. So I think you're in a window in which, I mean, this may sound flippant, but I think it's probably the most important part, right, which is in this period of innovative acceptance of broadband that consumers continually see the value proposition of open end-to-end internet evolution. They see, taste, and feel the products. By the way, if I ask my neighbors what net neutrality is, they don't know what I'm talking about. You all might, but let me tell you, there's no success here at the mass market level. Nobody knows what this is about, right? So they have to see the Slingbox. They have to see the TiVo. They have to use it. They have to integrate it in their way that their lives and then sort of raise their expectations about that. By the way, that'll be easier with generational change. Right. If I were doing a business today, I'd be spending all my time with 12 to 17-year-olds because they are going to, in a blink of the eye, be 25-year-olds. And they will have a very different expectation set. And I think what you got to do is make it financially and sort of very, very difficult in the market for different providers to behave in ways that you don't like because they would be punished for it by the consumer grassroots base itself. You know, when I first saw VoIP, I didn't know anybody who had ever really heard of it. But our attitude was, and Chris will stand up here and validate this, I said, we will try all our power to keep the world away from it for at least a year. Because my belief is if I get a couple hundred thousand Americans into the millions out there using this stuff, it'll be twice as hard to kill it in the cradle. It's just like pricing, right? If a consumer got $4 DSL, and got used to it, good luck trying to make it $50 DSL, which can be really distorting. Because, for example, in the net neutrality debate, I've heard people say don't charge, where you should do it economically correct is to charge end users, which an economist would say is the answer. But good luck going out trying to move 1295 DSL customers back to 40. Because, you know, in some ways, somebody had lost an opportunity already by the way that's gone to acclimate consumers. So that's one thing. I mean, I think, too, it's hard when, in public policy, when you get to the stage of actual battle over law to win against the powerful interests. But you have to be, I'd focus more on being the teachers. Right? We, long before the war comes, right, who's up there talking to staffers, inviting them to see technology, to demonstrate that technology, to come out and visit facilities, because it's a missionary effort, right? You have to evolve the country and its representatives to understanding and appreciating this before it gets to the stage of television ads and, you know, bill markups. And I don't think that goes on enough. I used to do it a lot just because I'm a geek and I like it. You know, I've been out in the country and seen almost firsthand most things we're talking about right there. But you'll have commissioners who'll never leave Washington and see this stuff and think they know what it is on paper. So there's a lot of regularized ways in which you become the mentor, the teacher, for the legislative process in the country so that when you do get a battle, you have more people who know what you're talking about.
That's a perfect way to end. Thank you very much. Please thank Chairman Powell.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I'm sorry.